This is Minnesota Native News. I'm Marie Rock. The Canadian Truth and Reconciliation Commission recently released a groundbreaking report officially recognizing the inhumane practices of the Canadian Indian boarding school system and the resulting historical trauma on Indigenous people. The report calls for 92 different policy changes to address that historical trauma. In the U.S., truth and reconciliation movements are emerging. Irma Visner, chairwoman of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe, is working with the National Congress of American Indians, calling for a National Commission on American Indian Boarding School Policy. This presentation features Irma Visner and Michael McNally, professor of religion at Carleton College. The two talk about the Episcopal Church's previous support of the doctrine of discovery and U.S. Indian boarding school policy. Visner discussed the movement to bring truth and reconciliation to the U.S. The event was at St. Mark's Episcopal Cathedral in Minneapolis on May 30th of 2015.
I want to give a little background on how we came to this point today. About 20 months ago, or it'd be 2 years in October, that I addressed an Indian child welfare gathering at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. Talked about the disparities in Indian child welfare. Now, we heard that history in the blanket exercise. Doctrine of discovery, and then along all these policies and doctrines to change Native people into another image, whether it was Christian or civilized or whatever it was. I'll tell you, we look back at our history and our spirituality and the riches, and today we may be very economically poor, but I'll tell you what, we have a rich cultural history. And that was all those attempts to destroy it. Doctrine of discovery, to take our lands. Because, and it was not only in the United States, it happened in Canada. It happened in other countries. So, because remember India, controlled by Britain, right? So doctrine of discovery and then the assimilation policies of the boarding schools. And then after the boarding schools, well, we still have boarding schools today. On the White Earth Reservation during that time, there were 4 boarding schools. And up until recently, maybe 20 years ago, the last boarding school closed. It has since burned down, and it's more than that. But we now have the Circle of Life Academy. It's a Bureau of Indian Affairs 638 contract school, brand new one. I worked 13 years to get that school. But, so then the boarding schools, and then, remember, in the blanket exercise, Indian children taken away from parents, from mothers, just taken away at the hospital and placed in non-Indian homes. So, in 1970s, up to 30 to 35% of American Indian children were in non-Indian homes throughout this country. And tribal leaders went to Congress. And it was not only tribal leaders, activists all over who are doing the work we are doing today. And the Indian Child Welfare Act was passed in 1978. And the compliance parts of the Indian Child Welfare Act are that tribes have the jurisdiction over their children. That Indian children, when need to go out of placement, that they go to relatives first. Well, that is never, that in Minnesota anyway, that's non-compliance with the Indian Child Welfare Act. The state and the county has not complied. So today, and the tribe is working very hard to gain that jurisdiction for our children. 20% of our kids, Indian children in Minnesota today, May 30th, 2015, 20% are in out-of-home placement today. They're in out-of-home placement, outside of their homes. So that I was asked, you know, please help us, because if we look at the history of our history, you know, we need to have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission here. And as busy as I am, these two women who asked me after that meeting in Minneapolis at the university asked me if I would help. And tribal leaders can do a lot. Yeah. I mean, so I think to myself, yes, even though I have one, this plate is full and this plate is full, yes, I'll help. And so I started. And I have many, many wonderful people in the Episcopal Church. One of them is Sarah Eaglehart, the national missioner for the Episcopal Church in the United States, Indian missioner. And Sarah's all over the country and world. Lakota woman, and just a good ally of not only the church, but a great ally for American Indians. Great advocate. And so I asked her, and we talked about it, and I started to get connected all over the country. First, with the Native American Rights Fund, which is in Boulder, Colorado. I don't know how many attorneys they have, but they take on Native American causes, and they have supported this. John Echohawk is their director, and he has supported the boarding school effort. And the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. It's just beginning. It's just starting. So, I've been busy this last year and a half. Three sessions at National Congress of American Indians, gathering resolutions. Minnesota Indian Education Association, National Indian Education Association, National Congress of American Indians, the National Council on Aging with Indian Elders, Minnesota Chippewa Tribe resolutions, plus individual tribes within Minnesota, the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, which is comprised of all 11 tribes in Minnesota. Yeah, because we need all of this support, because ultimately we are going to go to Congress, and within the boarding school era, and Michael will talk a bit about this, but there are no such thing as separation of church and state. United States government partnered in with denominations to carry out this assimilation policy that ultimately, generation after generation, destroyed our families, broke up our family system. And we are in that day today. Now, we wonder why we had a drug bust on White Earth Reservation and the Red Lake Reservation on Wednesday. 41 people indicted, heroin, methamphetamine, pills. Now, our people are broken people. Not everyone, definitely not, but too many are. Education on the White Earth Reservation, 50% of our people, 18 years and older, do not have a high school diploma. So, we have a lot of work. And we need the cooperation. We need the support. We need to be locking arm in arm with tribes, our church denominators, because they were, I should say they, we, all of us were a part of it. So, this is the first gathering, second gathering actually in Minnesota, on this issue. May 3rd, we were at the American Indian Center, and about 50 people were there. And the second, and, you know, the money for these came from the New Opportunities Grants through the National Episcopal Church. $8,000. And we're in three events. Third one's going to be on White Earth. So, here we are, and we have to be, you know, in order for people to be involved, a principal in organizing, you have to be informed. Then you get involved. So, okay, so we're ready to listen and ready to learn, Michael.
We have been learning, Irma. So, my name is Michael McNally. I teach religion at Carleton College, and you just heard from Irma, who, if you didn't know already, is the chairwoman of the White Earth Nation, the largest of the Native communities in Minnesota, and a lifelong Episcopalian. And so it means a lot to us, Irma, that not only are you here, but you're leading this effort. So the arc of what time we have here, in order to make sure we have some time for exchange, is to move very swiftly over the history of assimilation policy and boarding schools in particular, suggest something about the trauma, the historical trauma, though I think what Irma was just describing in terms of the brokenness and the graduation achievement gap and other sorts of things sort of in some ways goes without saying. In order to get to the healing portion, which has to do with the efforts that Irma is doing with the Native American Rights Fund and others, and so we will not do a good job if we don't get to that and get to that fairly swiftly. So Sue Moss has kindly agreed to flick the PowerPoint presentation, and we're going to go super fast through this. Many of you just came from consideration of the doctrine of discovery in the other context. And in much of the activism around trying to repudiate or reverse the doctrine of discovery, the attention really focuses on early land grabs. It's sort of the argument of this session that the same theological and legal premises that underwrote the land grab with the doctrine of discovery also informed, both theologically and legally, the processes of assimilation policy, which kick in the 1870s and continue either as formal policies through the 1930s or as more insidious sort of informal policies and effects after the 1930s and up to the present day with the kinds of things like adoption that Irma was speaking about. So we're moving from just talking about the doctrine of discovery authorizing taking of land, and we're talking about the doctrine of discovery, its theological premise that savage is to civilized as pagan or heathen is to Christian, and to carry that into the policies of assimilation, especially the boarding schools, with which the churches, and particularly in this region, the Episcopal Church, were deeply involved. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. I'm going to go quickly. Assimilation policy can be succinctly summed up by ABC. A is for allotment, and we had in the blanket exercise a discussion from the late 1880s on the fracturing of existing reservation lands that had been secured by treaties into small family farm plots, awarded usually to male heads of household, whether or not that's how Native communities held land, or whether they're matrilineal or whatnot. And this breakup of land led to the loss of about two-thirds of the existing reservation land bases prior to allotment policy. So it's a big deal. And the Episcopal Church, I'm going to not show all the slides about it, but the Episcopal Church, as well as the other churches involved with missionization, were not opposed to allotment. They thought it was actually a pretty decent thing, the idea being that Native peoples would ultimately own their own land, have title to it, and be protected under U.S. law. But that is a much more complicated story than that faith, that optimistic faith they had that that's how things would go down. We had Reverend George Ross here, an elder and a clergyman from the White Earth community, who spoke eloquently about the breakup at White Earth and other places of allotment and how that has mattered so much. As a footnote, not a footnote to the Red Lake people, but Red Lake Reservation was the Minnesota reservation that did not come under allotment policy out of the what Irma recognized as the wisdom of Red Lake leaders in the 1880s to refuse the bargain. C stands for civilization regulations, the criminalization of Native practices, including and especially religious and ceremonial practices that were seen to stand in the way of Indian assimilation. And B is for boarding schools, which we will turn to here. So next, please. This is a land map of White Earth. Red and the whole thing is White Earth. Red and blue is White Earth now. A lot of that land has been bought back by the tribe, but you can see a smattering as a result of allotment policy. And it's a much longer story, but let's move to the next slide to keep moving. Next, please. Civilization regulations. I want to spend a little time on this because I think as a student of American religious history, this is such an unsung story, and it needs to be known by every American. Between about 1881, 1882, 1883, the regulatory law, the administrative law, not law passed by Congress, but the stuff that came out of the executive branch in the Indian Bureau and then was administered in the various Indian agencies throughout the U.S., including in Minnesota, had on the books the directions from the agency head to go out and make rules on specific reservations about which dances, which ceremonies, which kinds of healing processes were going to be a problem for assimilation. And the missionary communities, the denominations, were completely in this period in collaborative charge of Indian reservations in the era of assimilation policy. So if you needed to stand in good stead as a Native person with the formal federal bureaucrat, you could go through the missionary, including the Episcopal Church, and vice versa. And what resulted in this was the outright criminalization of not just dances, but healing traditions too. The guy on the right is a Native person from North Dakota, and I forgot to put his name in there, but you can see he's wearing a ball and chain, and he was arrested on a hillock in North Dakota in the 1880s for doing a fasting for a vision, presumably as part of his own healing or as part of the healing for someone else. Next slide, please. The main consideration today is the boarding school, and this, I think, would be seen by most assimilation policy people as kind of the crown jewel of assimilation policy. The idea was hatched by Captain Pratt, Richard Henry Pratt, who, after service in the Civil War, was involved with some Southern Plains skirmishes, and took some prisoners of war from the Apache community, which included the great leader Geronimo. And instead of trying them or executing them, he had the reform idea that he could remake them. And he celebrated this experiment under the which became the slogan for the Carlisle Indian School, which he founded, and then the slogan really for all of the federally funded boarding schools. To kill the Indian and save the man. It's a chilling slogan, and it sounds so awful to our ears now. But it sounded so not awful to people, non-native people, in the late 19th century. And I sort of just ask you to sort of enter into what mentality would find you thinking that that is a form of saving people by destroying and devaluing everything that they speak, everything that they do. But at any rate, the boarding school, the program was, of course, to remove children from the nurture and embrace of their families, their elders, their grandparents. Grandparents were a big problem to these assimilation policy people. To remove them, and also from the land and the practices on the land, to these totalizing institutions, often in crowded conditions, where they were taught from the 1881, when the administration said it's going to be English-only education, and students would be punished in many cases for speaking their indigenous language. And right, Irma, there's a lot of survivors of boarding schools who speak English with an Ojibwe accent that you hear elders up at White Earth, and it's because of this. They went into the boarding school speaking Ojibwe. Many cases they lost their language, and yet they still speak English with that accent. And in many cases, well, it just defies words to speak about the atrocity that that inflicts on individuals. But here's the thing, folks. This isn't just a federal Indian policy. That's usually the way it's described. As Irma said, this was a collaboration between the denominations and the federal government. At its height in the 1883, there were 85 schools under contract. They were called religious contract schools with the federal government. Next slide, please. Let's skip it. I'll come back to these guys in a sec. Skip next. Go to the bar graphs. There we go. So these are the numbers of religious schools under federal contract, and you can see the at the height it's 1890 or so. Next slide, please. This is the distribution in 1889, and these are not federal schools. These are the religious schools that receive federal money. Next, please. And this is the federal funds expended on these. In the height in 1893, it's about $550,000 in 1893 dollars, which, according to one of our calculators, said is something more like $14 million in contemporary figures. The yellow is the Roman Catholic denomination. Green is the other denominations. Blue is the Episcopal denominations. But lest we become self-satisfied, those of us who are Episcopalians, that our colors aren't as big as the Roman Catholic colors, we need to reckon with the fact that our highly esteemed leader and first bishop of Minnesota, Henry Benjamin Whipple, who did so much, and these stories are well known, did so much on behalf of Native communities using his clout in Washington and elsewhere, was also among a small, relatively small circle of people who was more responsible for assimilation policy, including the boarding school policies, than pretty much anyone else. So can we go back to my Whipple pictures?
Yeah, and is there a correlation there with where mineral and lumber and railroad stuff is? Like the schools were where they really wanted the land? That's kind of what it looks like.
Great question for future research. I suspect there's correlations. There's always correlations. The Peace Corps, where does the Peace Corps go? Keep going back, please, to the Whipple picture. One more. Okay. So this is, if I want, especially, how many of you are Episcopalians in the room? Just so I'm not speaking to a bunch of Methodists. And okay, good. So this, to me, is maybe the most memorable thing as a non-native Episcopalian, because as a student of history, I've spent a lot of time with Whipple's documents, and there's a lot to like in this guy. He's the kind of guy I would want to have a cup of coffee with. He's just really interesting, and he, as he appears in this slide, went out of his way, cherished the time that he spent in both Dakota and Ojibwe communities. This is him celebrating Eucharist in 1862 in the encampment below Fort Snelling, the internment camp after the 1862 hostilities, where the Dakota were rounded up, many of whom suffered and even some perished in this camp. before they were exiled to land bases in South Dakota. But this is a picture of him in the midst of the people, in the midst of their pain, bringing the gospel and bringing the sacraments. And this was the kind of guy he was, right? There's a lot to him. Next slide, please. But it's also true that he was deeply fond of, not just personally fond of Pratt, but fond of the possibilities of assimilation policy, not just to make Christian converts of people, though that was part of it, but he really strongly believed that this was the way forward for Native community people. And it's this reckoning with those good intentions, being a pretty good guy, pretty honorable, at work on himself in a whole host of ways, and using his power in some ways for good, who could be one of the chief architects of the trauma that we're talking about. Now, it's a complicated story. One of our number queried me on this, and I said, I hope this didn't seem like we were Whipple bashing. It's really trying to scratch the surface of the hagiography of the sanctification of a human being and try to understand where the mistakes were and trying to look for where those of us who identify with Whipple might be making mistakes ourselves. Next slide, please. The federal office building is, of course, called the Whipple Federal Office Building near Fort Snelling. Next slide, please. This is the Lake Mohonk Retreat Center in upstate New York. And Lake Mohonk, from the 1880s through the first decade of the 1900s, was the scene of a retreat of elites, elected officials. The president of Carleton used to go to this thing, my own institution. And they went there to solve what they called, in two words, the Indian problem. The idea was to come up with policies that would help solve the Indian problem. Next slide, please. And I love this. This was found by a Carleton student of mine who was doing work on this. This is from the tribal newspaper, or a newspaper at White Earth anyway, in the 1880s. And if any of you are readers of The Onion, this reads like The Onion. We learn that an Eastern gentleman spent a whole hour and a half one day this week ruminating on the Indian question and making notes of observations derived from the hotel window. Next slide, please. But here, as you can see, I won't read this because it'll take us too long, but the notion of English-only education in boarding schools was not only okayed, but it was affirmed deeply by these denominational leaders as an important way forward. Next, please. So I don't want to have the conversation happen right here. I want to continue so we get to the real conversation that Irma's going to run. But I'm just going to pose this question so you have it to kind of gnaw on. What does it mean to learn from an historian's perspective that Whipple wasn't just a good guy on these issues? What would that take for us? What kind of soul-searching does the Diocese of Minnesota need to do on this part? I think that's a useful question for all of us. Let's go to the next slide, please. So moving to trauma. Can you go to one slide that says trauma by the numbers? So the U.S. formally acknowledges in 1934 that it had made a lot of mistakes with the boarding schools. There still are boarding schools, but they happen on a slightly different platform after that. The numbers up here, in a way, sort of don't speak for themselves. They have complex causes. But what Irma is working on suggests that there are some connective tissues between this history and these policies that not only the federal government but our denominations were part of for theological as well as legal and political and economic reasons. It's on our watch, I suppose one could say, that fewer than 1,000 Ojibwe speakers live today in Minnesota, that housing and health and poverty rates can be as troubling as they are. And this has to do with this boarding school history. So I'm going to show now a very brief testimony from a film called Our Spirits Don't Speak English.
My name is Andrew Windyboy. I'm a Chippewa Cree I did two boarding schools, one in Wapton Indian School in Wapton, North Dakota, and the other one is Flandreau Indian School in Flandreau, South Dakota. Mid-60s to early 70s took me to the boarding school where I wasn't allowed to talk my native tongue or practice my native ways. Numerous times they'd put on this big old white, big huge white cone, put on there, it says dunce. I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know English. They put it on me, make me wear it all over. Kids would laugh at me. It took me away from all of that and punished me for talking that. It was my first language. I didn't know any other language. So whenever I talk, it came out. Cree would come out, and whenever I talk, I get hit. I got hit so much I lost my tongue. I lost my native tongue. The only thing I remember was my Indian name. Which is Ksenukihu, means old man eagle. That's the only Cree I knew. They beat me. Every day, they beat me. They cut off my hair, made me kneel in front of the door where everybody come in. Everybody make fun of me when they come by me, rub my head and laugh at me. Because I was talking. They caught me talking. I hope someday somebody will hear me. I hope nobody has to go through this. We have to have our own language. Because what we do when we talk to our spirits, they don't understand English. They look at you, you be talking the English. What are you saying? That's it, Wayne. That's my Wayne. See, nobody's saying that in Cree. Like, now you didn't know what I just said. That was a hard time in my life. I'll always remember it. For that white man, it's a terrible shame for him to be treating people like this. Because we are a people. We just need to be accepted.
We think the boarding schools was an era that has passed. But the Wahpeton Indian School and the Flandreau Indian School are still operating today, where this gentleman attended. The philosophy is different, but they're still there. So,
I'm going to turn it over to you in a sec, Irma. To make things go quickly, though, so you just heard one testimony. I'm going to sort of set up Irma's remarks into questions by saying that in Canada, in 2007, as a result of a class action lawsuit brought by survivors of residential schools in the Canadian context, and there's something kind of structurally similar. There's a lot of differences with the Canadian context, but there's some structural similarities, and one of the structural similarities there is that the class action lawsuit named the Government of Canada and the Roman Catholic Church in Canada, the United Church of Canada, and the Anglican Church of Canada. And as part of the settlement involved payments. It involved an exploration of abuse payments, special abuse payments, but the suit was about abuse, about emotional, psychological, sexual abuse of kids and the loss of culture and language. And as a key part of this, without just having money, reparations and justice, a truth and reconciliation process was established. And to date, they've had about a little over 6,000 statements that have been taken, such as the one that you just were witnessing. Very, very difficult truths for people to say. But as the Logic of Truth and Reconciliation Commissions has it, really important truths to tell in structured settings where governments and churches and other institutions are structurally sort of present. And these accounts in Canada are archived at the University of Manitoba. And so the idea is not just to resolve the conflict with payments, but to resolve the conflict by teaching about that history. And we're at a moment, even though you said that Flandreau and there's still people living, but a lot of the people that experienced the trauma of the boarding schools themselves firsthand are soon not going to be with us. And the importance of getting their stories is huge for their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren and other people downstream from them to be able to know how that experience has shaped the family stories, the community stories, and everything else. So Irma, do you want to say something more about where you're at and open it up for questions?
Yes. Like I said, we are only at the beginning. This country, the greatest democracy in the world, has not apologized to us. I have been told there is a little apology buried in some military bill someplace, but it has not been our president standing on the White House lawn and calling us as Native Americans. And first of all, apologizing. Because what we've seen, and I don't want to see, I just talked to Marcy. Now, she has recorded some of her story. But people, she said, some of the people don't want to hear it. You're carrying this chip on your shoulder. Come on now, get over it. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Well, some of us can. But so many can't. Unable. And so, now our goal is to go to Congress. But we need to build this momentum and this organizing and this cooperation. At least in Minnesota, this is, like I said before, this is the first gathering in Minnesota. Minnesota, I mean, where 11 tribes are. Come on, you know, let's call this a summit here. But I'm starting with the church because this is the partner who is interested. And so, the last session, what can we do? General Convention is coming up this summer, and I'm not a delegate. I've been to General Convention a couple times as a delegate, but I'm not. We need to get a resolution passed to address this traumatic history and call for healing in our communities. And we can't just do it with volunteers. We need the finances to do it for programs. One thing. The other thing, we do need to establish the truth. For some reason, our history has been hidden. Not taught in the schools. If you look at those photo, those portraits out there, or those pictures of those portraits that are hanging in our state capitol, capitol's under renovation now, and we as tribes ought to have something to say about those portraits that are going to hang again in our state capitol. Portraits that run the theme of discovery amongst us. Our women there with bare to the waist. So disrespectful. And yet hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of school children go there every spring because I'm down there. Yeah, we have a lot of work to do. And I know I don't have all the, we could sit and talk about this. I'm just so thankful we've had this gathering today. We'll have another one on the White Earth Reservation, July 18th. And Steve Newcomb, who is co-founder of the Indigenous Legal Institute in California, will be our keynote speaker. Worked on the doctrine of discovery, where has been an advocate and working on the doctrine of discovery for about 30 years. So that's coming. But we can't stop here. You know, the boarding schools, the reason, you know, Minnesota, the reason we as American Indians, Ojibwe, Dakota, Anishinaabe people, the reason why we're Episcopalians or Roman Catholics is because denomination, the government divided up denominations in this country. You'll go to some place like Alaska, and you'll find a lot of Presbyterian natives because that's where the sort of government worked with them. White Earth, Episcopalians and Roman Catholics. And I shouldn't say this because I've seen so much pain. You know, I have great respect, but I don't share that same feeling of Bishop Tutu, who said, well, they got the land, but we got the Bible. No, we should have both. That's it.
This is Minnesota Native News. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at MN Native News.
Minnesota Native News is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.